In this week's episode of BSD Now, we are looking at the future, looking back at us. Joanne McNeil, in particular, on Cyberpunk, and why ZFS reports less available disk space is what Clara Systems tells us, and how we are destroying software in one way or the other. Another article is about FreeBSD 13.5 overcoming the Y2038 problem with UFS1, 1972 Unix version 2 beta resurrected by the Unix Hysterical Society. Some thoughts on why INET deactivation didn't catch on, and more in this week's episode of BSD. BSD Now, episode 604, Future Looks Bad. Recorded on the 20th of March, 2025.
This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that.
Hi, we are your hosts, Benedikt Reuschling.
And Tom Jones.
Yes, the one only.
You changed the pattern. No, as in we said in the pre-show, there's about 500 just on Wikipedia. It's weird that HTTP error codes don't go up to 6.
Yeah, right? Error 600? I don't know, computer not found or something? Or
I want to check.
Internet not found. That would be awesome.
List of HTTP status codes. Yeah, they only go up to 5. Informational response, success, redirection, client error, server error. You could add network error.
I still like the one page too ugly.
Page too ugly?
Yeah, if you have too many frame sets in there.
I've never received that.
Frame sets aren't a thing anymore for a long while, and it's good.
Okay. But first up in the show, the thing we're doing, Benedikt. I'm just nonsense. First up, we have an article in Filmmaker Magazine. I don't know why this is the main article. It's really confusing. The future looking back at us, Joanne McNeil on Cyberpunk. This year, last year, is the 40th anniversary of William Gibson's classic novel Neuromancer. It's a work of singular brilliance that arrived as part of a new vanguard back in 1984 in the Washington Post. Author and editor Gardner DeZois identified Gibson as part of an emerging trend. New science fiction authors who had eschewed formulaic space operas for bizarre, hard-edged, high-tech stuff. DeZois? This is a really
good name. DeZois, maybe? Francaisish? Francois?
That is a hard name. DeZois called these authors the cyberpunks, and the label caught on. Key works of cyberpunk like Neuromancer were produced in the 80s alongside the boom in personal computers, and again in the 90s as subscriptions to online services and sales of modems took off. Now, in reality, two-thirds of the planet has access to the internet, and virtual worlds are no longer the domain of console cowboys. But curiously, cyberpunk is still often referenced as a living rather than retrospective category. What is it about cyberpunk that has endured? Jared Shurin, the editor of The Big Book of Cyberpunk, published last year, so 2023, argues that the legacy of cyberpunk remains not only relevant, but ubiquitous. His anthology, spanning more than 1,000 pages and organized with great care and ambition, gathers writers from the first decade of cyberpunk like Gibson, Sterling, Stevenson, and Cadogan, and puts them in conversation with emerging science fiction authors like Wohl, Talabi, Madeline Ashbean, and QNTM. Another recent work of creation, Cyberpunk, Envisioning Possible Futures Through Cinema, which opens at the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures in October, likewise has a program that spans from Blade Runner, Tron, to recent films including Neptune Frost, Alita, Battle Angel, and Night Raiders. Filmmaker Alex Riviera, Sleeper Dealer, was commissioned to write an original script for the exhibition. Both the Academy of Motion Pictures exhibition and the Big Book of Cyberpunk approach cyberpunk expansively to highlight recent work by diverse talent around the globe. Introducing the anthology, Shurin writes, core cyberpunk was demographically homogenous. And that tunneling the genre to the future rather than looking back is an attempt to capture how many writers from different backgrounds, demographic, geographic, and artistic, took on the challenge of writing about our relationship with technology and one another. Likewise, in the exhibition catalogue for the Cyberpunk show, curator Doris Berger writes that she intended to highlight classic cyberpunk as well as newer films with characters, stories about people of color, women, members of the LGBTQ plus community. Attempts to gather a less demographically homogenous cyberpunk movement are as old as cyberpunk itself. Fanzines published essays like Cyberpunk in Cuba by Sarah Uno, highlighting authors outside the mainstream in unexpected regions. When Gibson's Burning Chrome was published in 1986, the writer Janine Gamal, in an open letter, expressed irritation with Bruce Sterling's introduction to the story collection. Sterling had characterized the previous decade of science fiction as confused, self-involved, and stale. Gamal countered that he had whisked under the rug the radical advances in the genre by feminist writers. Some of those feminist writers in the 70s, like Joanna Russ and Marge Piercy, detailed proto-cyberpunk body modifications of technologies to jack into new realities. Their fiction would inspire Donna Haraway, who published A Cyborg Manifesto, a work of theory with themes simpatico with cyberpunk in 1983. There's an expansive history beyond cyberpunk, but a project like The Big Book of Cyberpunk branches outward from narrow roots instead of incorporating it. Gibson himself said he winced when he first heard the term cyberpunk. He was older than the other writers in the cohort, 36, when Neuromancer was published in 1984, and went along the label as an uncomfortable passenger. Funny thing is, if cyberpunk still feels alive and well 4 years into the future, they'll find the reason why in Neuromancer. As the cyberpunk fanzine Cheap Truth put it back in the 80s, Gibson concentrates on surfaces as a way of getting at essences. You can see in some of the finest sentences how the rhythm of Burroughs rubbed off on him and where Ballard's spatial, directional rather than inner space obsessions were influenced. But Gibson's writing is always lucid, never surreal. Machines in his novels are plugged into something. Things happen for a reason. Alienation rather than madness is what animates his characters. They are users of software and hardware and data systems in cities and networks of infrastructure siloed before connecting with others through network machines. Rereading Neuromancer over the summer, I was dazzled anew by the author's uncanny prose, how Gibson wrestles technical jargon, the stuff of developer documentation and instruction manuals, out of its familiar context to create a neon mood of intrigue. We all know how the book opens. The sky above the port was the color of a television turned to a dead channel. But another evocative line, just as stunning, happens a few pages later as protagonist Cased is thinking about his lost love, Linda Lee. He remembers her face bathed in restless laser light, features reduced to a code, her cheekbones flaming scarlet as wizards' castles burned, forehead drenched with azure when Munich fell to the tank war, mouth washed with hot gold as a gliding cursor sparks from the wall of a skyscraper canyon. An arcade is a setting that readers in 1984 would have been well acquainted with, but Gibson writes about what's happening on that floor like the future worlds in the same book. Elements of his style are consistent across the book and his body of work. His writing is highly visual and granular, with fastidious attention to design and spatiality. The first novel he published in the new millennium, Pattern Recognition, is set in the present that reads like science fiction. Likewise, his work set in the future reads like realism of that future. Gibson has said in multiple interviews that he got idea for Cyberface appearing first in his short story Burning Chrome and expanded in Neuromancer before there was much of an internet to speak of. After watching kids in an arcade wrapped in gameplay, looking like they'd climb inside those blinking and dinging cabinet machines, in Neuromancer, he captured the hunger to experience that technology and the all-consuming attention of being jacked in, how technology can get inside you, change you, and leave you hungry for more. This was happening in arcades and is happening in our digital experiences 40 years later. While the cyberspace of Neuromancer is so vastly unlike what the internet has turned out to be, Gibson writes like he lives there. Even reading it today, you believe him. Yeah, no, it's cool. The people that write about writing like to write a lot when they write about writing.
Yeah, it's kind of a meta thing.
Pretty much.
Speaking of our writing, we have a longer writing next in another Clara article about the ZFS pool space accounting and why there is often less reported than you would think. And this is from Jim Salter, and it's long, but definitely worth reading. So the beginning is ZFS space accounting can be tricky, often showing less available storage than expected. This guide breaks down how ZFS tracks the space, the impacts that snapshots have, and how features like compression and deduplication affect storage use. And so he starts the actual article. It's not exactly difficult to figure out how much space you've got left when you're using OpenZFS, but it is different from doing so on traditional file systems, as OpenZFS brings considerable more complexity to the table. Space accounting in OpenZFS requires a different approach to factors like snapshots, compression, and deduplication. So here is the basic of file systems. In traditional non-copy-on-write file systems, so not ZFS, space management is simple. You've got a certain number of physical sectors available on your single storage device. Some of them are used, and some of them are not. In such a file system, when we want to know the number of free sectors, we subtract the used sectors from the total available, and presto, free space. Similarly, we might subtract the free sectors from the available sectors to get the total amount of used space. None of these values are ambiguous and all are part of fixed sum system. So OpenZFS brings a new concept to file system management that muddied this simple picture a bit. Snapshots, inline compression, and block level deduplication. To effectively manage our OpenZFS file system, we'll need to begin by understanding three properties: used, refer, and avail, or available. All three properties revolve around the status of logical sectors, not physical ones. Physical sectors are literal units individual to each raw device in the pool. Logical sectors are the sectors made directly available to your applications. Proper space accounting in OpenZFS depends on understanding these distinctions. To see how this plays out, let's assume we have a pair of storage devices, each of which offers precisely 1 megabyte of storage, or 1 MIP of storage. 1 MIP divided by 4K is 256. You can do that on your fingers if you like. So each device has 256 physical 4 kilobyte sectors. In a simple mirror VDEV with both drives, the VDEV provides 512 physical sectors, the combined sector count of all devices, but only 256 logical sectors, which are the sectors available to your applications for reading and writing. So with three of these mythical 1 megabyte storage devices and put them in a 3 wide RAID set 1 VDEV, this VDEV would offer 768 physical sectors and 512 logical sectors. In short, logical sectors represent a storage space after redundancy or parity. Then there's a section about understanding the difference between used, refer, and available. So used refers to the number of logical sectors allocated to a dataset and its children. Blocks allocated to subdatasets and snapshots count towards used. Okay, then refer. This refers, to the number of logical sectors actively referred to by the dataset, excluding its children and any snapshots. And avail refers to the number of logical sectors available to be written with new data. In the absence of imposed quotas, avail refers directly to the number of unused logical sectors in the pool as a whole. Otherwise, it refers to the number of logical sectors by which the dataset may grow without exceeding its quota. So there's a couple of examples in doing it on a test system. What about snapshots? Understanding space accounting in OpenZFS snapshots. Now that we understand what used and refer mean, let's look at what snapshots do about that. Worse, for the worse or for the better. Remember, OpenZFS is a copy and write file system. This means that every block is immutable once written. You can't ever alter the value of a block once it's created. You can only read it or destroy it. When you or an application tells OpenZFS, "I want to change the value of this block," OpenZFS only seems to do what you asked it to do. In fact, it really creates an entirely new block with the changes or with the changed value you requested. Then, as a single atomic operation, OpenZFS unlinks the original block from live file system and replaces it with a link to the new block with the new value you just edited. So how snapshots impact space availability? In the absence of snapshots, this freshly unlinked block is effectively destroyed and becomes a part of the free space available to the dataset. But if you took a snapshot of the dataset prior to editing the block, the original block remains immutable once unlinked from the file system. It is still referenced to all of the snapshots newer than the birth date of this block. So the same he demonstrates in a test output. So he creates a... So he has a couple of directories. No, not directories, files here, 0, 1, and 2, and creates a snapshot on the pool on this one. And now he has the reference 1 gigabyte in this case. So after taking the snapshot demo shot, we see that neither used nor the refer of the test pool has changed. Both still report only 1 gigabyte. This is because refer of the dataset and the refer of its snapshot both still point to exactly the same blocks. Even though we have a new snapshot dataset which refers to 1 gigabyte of data, the actual number of logical sectors requires to store the total amount of data has not changed. So here goes deleting a file with snapshots present. Now what happens if we delete this file? A couple of things, actually, and they happen quickly. The first thing is we see is that nothing apparently changed. This is because modern OpenZFS uses asynchronous destruction. When you delete files or destroy snapshots, the system acknowledges the command immediately, but it can take seconds or even minutes to the entire operation to complete in the background. And so how space accounting adjusts over time? Let's wait a few seconds for OpenZFS to finish unlinking those blocks, and then he runs the command again to see the output of ZFS list, RT all the test pool with the subdata sets. Now we can see the actual effects of deleting a 1 gigabyte file, which also exists in a snapshot. Since the snapshot is a child of the data set, the test pool /0/1/2 still shows the same 1 gigabyte used that it already did or always did. But the test pool 012 now refers to only 13.6 kilobytes. Similar to the root dataset of the test pool itself, this amounts to just a handful of metadata sectors. Okay, there's more about snapshots and space availability. A little further down, we see that reclaiming space from snapshots. Now, how do I get my space back? This is usually the place where heads have begun to firmly spin. In the normal file system, you reclaim storage space simply by deleting it. But on OpenZFS, we need to not only delete the files, but destroy any snapshots with references. So the thing is, as we saw in the last section, the same file may be referenced by multiple snapshots. This makes finding space to reclaim significantly more challenging in a system which regularly takes snapshots. And Jim would know about this because he wrote the snapshot backupping tool, Xanoid and Syncoid. So that's directly referenced here. We could mess around trying to use the find command, looking for which snapshots contain which files, of course. But since the goal is finding space rather than finding files, there's an easier way. We'll use ZFS destroy with a couple of special arguments. Ooh, look at that. Assuming we'd like to reclaim another 1 gigabyte of space, which snapshots of test pools should we destroy? So first we list all the snapshots or everything from a pool. Then we do ZFS destroy -NV, simulate and verbose, show us what you would do. And ZFS tells us, I would destroy test pool, that one snapshot, and I would reclaim 13 kilobytes. And now if you, for the test pool at dataset snapshot 0, I would reclaim 13K, and at snapshot 1, I would reclaim 1 gigabytes. There we have it. We can use ZFS destroy with the special arguments N and V for dry run and verbose, respectively. Running the command shows what issuing a ZFS destroy would do without actually losing any data. There's a list of ZFS native tools. First to mention is, of course, ZFS list to display what available space is there. There's Zpool list as well. And a little further down with more examples, there are file system agnostic tools that are also giving you the similar but maybe a bit skewed values. There is DU, the disk usage tool. This works fine by finding all the files in one or more directories, adding them up individually, and reporting the totals. So this is good. Don't use DF because it never knows about ZFS. There is a section about exactly this, so I'll let you read that, dear reader, listener. And in the conclusion, they write, due to the vagaries of inline compression and synchronous deduplication, when either or both are enabled, it's not actually possible to actually predict how much space is left or which is on a ZFS file system at all. With the caveat, we can at least see how many blocks are available, preferably using the ZFS native tool, ZFS list. We should not use the tool Zpool list for the same purpose because it outputs and a biggest listing, unpredictable and not usefully organized for the purpose. Meanwhile, file system agnostic applications get a good enough picture of what's going on most purposes. In particular, they should at least get the value of avail correct in terms of how many blocks are left to write to, even if they have no idea how compression or deduplication might impact that value. Last, as for storage administrators, presumably like yourselves, dear reader, you should now understand enough about the OpenZFS native tools and space accounting to finally have a handle on this deceptively complicated answers to how much space you've used, how much you've got left, and how to reclaim it. Yeah, good article. Good to know if, these things.
If you're going to copy something from ZFS to another file system, DEU is helpful to know how big it is. Because if you just look at ZFS, it might be much smaller than you think.
Yeah, compression hits you in a good way.
Yeah, the lack of compression hits you. Mm-hmm. Next, we have a litany for on antires.com. We are destroying software. We are destroying software by no longer taking complexity into account when adding features or optimizing some dimension. We are destroying software with complex build systems. We are destroying software with an absurd chain of dependencies, making everything bloated and fragile. We are destroying software telling new programmers, don't invent the wheel, but reinventing the wheel is how you learn how things work, and is the first step to make new, different wheels. We are destroying software by no longer caring about backward APIs, API compatibility. We're destroying software by pushing for rewrites of things that work. We're destroying software by jumping on every new language, paradigm, and framework. We're destroying software by always underestimating how hard it is to work with existing complex libraries versus creating our stuff. We're destroying software by always thinking that the de facto standard for XYZ is better than what we can do, tailored specifically for our use case. We're destroying software claiming that code comments are useless. We're destroying software mistaking it for a purely engineering discipline. We are destroying software by making systems that no longer scale down. Simple things should be simple to accomplish in any system. We are destroying software trying to produce code as fast as possible, not as well designed as possible. We are destroying software, and what will be left will no longer give us the joy of hacking. That's a lot of the same words. From cycling, having cycled a lot, you then have to fix bicycles because things break. Like they are literally moving parts, you know, it's metal moving together. And
yeah, not those e-bikes that you just sit on.
E-bikes still move, right? Yeah. If you don't wash a bike, it destroys itself quicker because it forms the mud and dirt will form a paste with bits of metal in it and you get a grinding paste. So things wear out faster. So clean bikes are fast bikes. Clean bikes last longer. But I didn't actually start doing any proactive maintenance on a bike until the first bike I really owned was like 6 years old. And through that, I learned that it is incredibly difficult to learn how to fix things if you only have broken things to learn with.
Yeah.
All of the instructions and advice for how things work talk about things in their designed state, like the steady state, how they are meant to be. So all the pieces move correctly, the springs are the right tension, they're not blocked by anything.
Yeah.
And if you have something with one issue, you can easily figure out what's wrong with it. But if you have something with 100 issues, it's really hard to figure out. As a really good case in point, I spent ages trying to index the gears on my bike. Indexing the gears lets you have a gear shifter with stops, so it's indexed rather than being a continuous drive. And so it snaps through different positions. And it has a tiny amount of movement to do this. If the springs that pull the derailleur are worn out, so they are overstretched, so they don't have the same tension in them, you can't do this. But if you are learning how to fix bikes by working on broken bikes, you can't fix this. You need exposure to things that work. And so, you know, there's some contradictory comments in this litany, like, you know, we should build complex things and simple things. But yeah, people should go and build new stuff, because building new stuff is the way that you learn how things work from something that already works. Or if it doesn't work, it isn't like super broken. But it's always really difficult. You know, we're doing Google Summer Code Rundown for BSD, and it's always hard to pitch projects which are a sensible size for a student to do, because they always seem too small. And yeah, they always fill up all the available time. No matter how big the project is. The proposed projects from Google are like, create a web interface to welcome new contributors and send them an email. And our projects are like, port FreeBSD to run on micro VM.
Make it really difficult.
Invent a new entire new system. add instruction level tracing to dtrace. Yeah. And yeah, students do these things. They're very impressive, but also, you know, they've got to be careful not to pick a system which is already broken and suggest that somebody work on it. The problem is that the things which
is cruel.
The things that work don't have interesting problems.
Mm.
Yeah, the things that work have horrible problems. Like, add a new network protocol to FreeBSD is great fun.
Yeah.
Go and do it. It's, you know, a couple of weeks. It's fun. Fix locking in the socket layer is a multi-year long project by some of the most knowledgeable and talented engineers in the world.
With plenty of head scratching, yeah.
And the open problems in the socket layer are like that. But they're open because they're too hard to approach. And so, yeah.
Is there anything in between that? It's still challenging, but not overwhelmingly difficult.
You know, the problem with the issue with problems like that is that they get fixed really easily. Like, yeah, the things that can be fixed get fixed for things which are looked at. The nice thing about the BSDs is there's not, you know, an unending supply of people looking at things, so there are still a lot of interesting problems to work on.
That's true.
There's stuff to come and do. I always like to think that BSDs are not over complex, and we're quite good at, you know, one thing does things well. We have issues, and some things are inherently complex, and the complex things are as complex as they need to be, and other systems aren't like that. And I think a lot of our listeners would probably agree with that, and then they would start using angry words about people by the name. I think that's how it would go.
Okay.
Should we do the next part of the show?
Yeah, I might as well.
I'm not very good at segueing today. I'm really sorry, JT.
I'll do the segue. I don't have one, but I can do them.
Segues are really dangerous. You know, you don't want to ride any machine that killed its creator.
Yeah.
No, you know, tradition of people who invented torture devices was to be executed with their torture device.
Yeah, just to see if they really work.
No, it's because you want to punish anybody coming up with something that evil, and you don't want them going and making something more evil for someone else.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's good.
Anyway, yeah.
So before we start creating more machines... News Roundup has an article mentioning something we did call out a couple of weeks before when the actual commit has happened. So FreeBSD 13.5 overcomes the UFS 2038 problem to push it out to year 2106. So that is the article on Phoronix, and they say, following last week's FreeBSD 13.5 Beta 1 release, that was on February, so that has been a while. So they released the kickoff, the next FreeBSD 13.0 release that will also end the series. FreeBSD 13.5 Beta 2 is out this weekend or by now. While FreeBSD 13 will be end of life in just over 1 year's time, FreeBSD 13.5 Beta 2 at that time doesn't extend the UFS2 file system, or does extend the UFS1 file system to now support dates through the year 2106. So that's a long time on. So UFS file system support had been plagued by the year 2038 problem, where it wouldn't be able to properly account for dates after the 19th of January 2038. I'm still hopefully alive by then. But now with the newest code for FreeBSD 13.5, the date handling within this file system has been reworked to now support file dates up to 7th of February 2106. Not sure about my age at this. There will be a BSD now. Not at this time. Well, we'll see. Only avatars like AI being us, impersonating us. So the details of this commit for those interested from Kirk McCusick, he provides the full commit message in the article. The year 2106 in turn is when an unsigned 32-bit binary integer will not roll over with the time since the Unix epoch compared to the year 2038 problem with being assigned 32-bit integer. So there's a couple of extras about 13.5 beta 2, but since that is out now, it's not newsworthy otherwise. Okay, yeah, so UFS1 now can do many, many more years without doing crazy things.
Okay, next up we have an email to the Unix Historical Society mailing list from Yufeng Gao. 1972 Unix V2 beta resurrected. Hi everyone, first time poster here. Near the end of last year, I did some forensic analysis on the DMR tapes and had some fun playing around with them. Warren forwarded a few of my emails to this list at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, but it was never my intention for him to be my messenger. So I'm posting here myself now. Here's an update on my work with the S1 and S2 tapes. I managed to get a working system out of them. The S1 tape is a Unix init deck tape containing the kernel, while S2 includes most of the distribution files. The S1 kernel is, to date, the earliest machine-readable Unix kernel, sitting between V1 and V2. It differs from the Unix June 72 kernel in the following ways. It supports both V1 and V2 8.0s out of the box, whereas the unmodified June 72 kernel supports only V1. The core size has been increased to 16 kilobytes, 8K words, while the unmodified Unix 72 June 72 kernel has 8 kilobyte, 4K word user core. On the other hand, its syscall table matches that of V1 and the June 72 kernel, lacking all V2 syscalls. Since it aligns with V1 in terms of syscalls, has the V2 core size and can run V2 binaries, I consider it a V2 beta. And a login prompt, some C. It's somewhat picky about the environment. So far, AAP's PDP-1120 emulator is the only one capable of booting the kernel. SimH and ersatz11 both hang before reaching the login prompt. This makes installation from the S1, S2 tapes difficult, as AAP's emulator does not support the TC11. The intended installation process involves booting from S1 and restoring files from S2. What I did was extract the files from the S1 tape and place them on an empty RF disk, then installed the June 72 kernel. After booting from the RF under SimH, I extracted the remaining files from S2. Finally, I replaced the June 72 kernel with the S1 kernel using a hex editor, resulting in an RF disk image containing only files from S1 and S2. The RF image is bootable under AAP's emulator, but not SimH. The RF disk can be downloaded here, direct link. Interestingly, it's init program that does not mount the RK to slash user, suggesting slash user was stored on the RF. Cool. Go and check this out in the show notes if you wish to do some old Unix.
Yes, it's just what you need in an old-fashioned way. We stick a little bit about old-fashioned things that are still around. Chris Seiberman, yet another blog post. Some thoughts on why INET deactivation didn't catch on. So INETD, he writes, is a traditional Unix super server that listens on multiple IP ports and runs programs in response to activity on them. It dates from the era of 4.3 BSD. In theory, INETD can act as a service manager of sorts for daemons like the BSDR commands. Don't use those. Saving them from having to implement things like daemonization. And in fact, it turns out that one version of this is how these daemons were run in 4.3 BSD. He links to another blog post he wrote about exactly this. However, running daemons under INETD never really caught on. Even in 4.3 BSD, some important daemons ran outside of INETD. And these days, it's basically dead. You could ask why, and I have some thoughts on that. The initial version of INETD only officially supported running TCP services in a mode where each connection ran a new instance of the program. Call it the CGI model. On the machines of the 1980s and the 1990s, this wasn't a particularly attractive way to run anything but relatively small and simple programs, and ones that didn't have to do much work on startup. In theory, you could possibly run TCP services in a mode where they were passing the server socket and then accepted new connections themselves for a while. In practice, no one seems to have really written daemons that supported this. Daemons that supported an INETD mode generally meant the run a copy of the program for each connection mode. Possibly some of them supported both modes of INETD operation, but system administrators would pretty much assume that it's a daemon's documentation saying that just INETD mode, that it meant the CGI model. Another issue is that INETD is not a service manager. It will start things for you, but that's it. It won't shut down things for you, although you can get it to stop listening on a port. And it won't tell you what's running. You get to expect the process list. On Unixes, with a System 5 init system or something like it, running your daemons as standalone things gave you access to start, stop, restart, status, and so on. Service management options that might even work, depending on the quality of the INETD scripts involved. Since daemons had better usability when run as a standalone service, system administrator and others had relatively little reason to push for INETD support, especially in the second mode. In general, running any important daemon under INETD has many of the same downsides as systemd socket activation services, as practical matter, system administrators like to know what important daemons are up and running right away, and they don't have some hidden issue that will cause them to fail to just start when you want them. The normal CGI-like INetD mode also means that any changes to configuration files and the like take effect right away, which may not be what you want. System administrators tend to like controlling when daemons restart with new configurations. Yep. All of this is likely tied to what we could call cultural factors. And I suspect the authors of daemons perceived running standalone as the more serious and prestigious option, the one for serious daemons like NameD and Sendmail, and INetD activation to be at most a secondary feature. If you wrote a daemon that only worked with INetD activation, you'd practically be proclaiming that you saw your program as a low importance thing. This obviously reinforced itself to the degree that I'm surprised SSHD even has an option to run under INetD. While some Linuxes are now using systemd socket activation for SSHD, they aren't doing it via its dash -i option. The PS reads, there are some services that still do generally run under INetD or XINetD, often the modern replacement, CF. For example, I'm not sure if the Amanda backup system even has an option to run its daemon as a standalone thing. Huh. Interesting.
I've never heard of that. So yeah, some things are really annoying. Like TFTPD will only run through INetD, which is just infuriating.
Ooh, yeah.
Chris, I don't know if you listen, but if you listen, please, please contrast for me and us, INetD and serverless platforms. Like, just think about both of them. Because I don't know how they differ, actually. Serverless seems very close to doing CGI style things where the daemon startup is completely separated from the process handler startup. And like INetD makes sense for things which were always all the daemon process is going to do is accept and fork, and then something else will happen. Mm. And there's no state to carry between connections. Like, that makes sense. But you just get, you end up underwater on other things. I have a lot of thoughts about INetD. I wrote an article about it for someone.
Mm.
Okay. If you believe in artificial intelligence, take 5 minutes to ask it about stuff you know well. Here's a Mastodon thread from a year ago. Just a quick check on how ChatGPT is getting on. Me, who reassigned the species... Oh, I'm going to pronounce those words wrong. I'm sorry.
Mm.
Who reassigned the species Brachiosaurus branchi to its own genus and when? ChatGPT... This species, Brachiosaurus branchi, was reassigned to its own genus, Giraffatitan, by the paleontologist Michael Janesh in 1914. Me. Dude, that's so wrong, I can't even. ChatGPT. I apologize for the mistake in the previous response. The reassignment of the Brachiosaurus branchi to Giraffatitan branchi was not done by Michael Janesh. The correct attribution goes to the paleontologist Ernst Stromer, who reclassified it in 1914. Me, that answer is even worse. Stromer had nothing to do with the genus or the species name. ChatGPT, I apologize for the confusion in my previous response. The reassignment of Brachiosaurus branchi to Giraffatitan branchi was actually done by paleontologist Werner Janisch, not Michael Janisch, in 1914. Sigh. Regular readers, I do not know where this article came from. Regular readers will know the actual sequence of events was, and so all BSD Now listeners will know this too. Riggs, 1903, named the genus Brachiosaurus and its type species Brachiosaurus altothorax. Janisch, 1914, named the second species of this genus, the Brachiosaurus branchi. Paul, 1998, considered the two species separate at a subgeneric level, a taxonomic level that is rarely, if ever, used in vertebrate paleontology, and named the subgenus Brachiosaurus giraffatitan branchi. Olovesky, 1991, used the subgenus and species combination giraffatitan branchi without comment in a self-published booklet, a combination which was not followed by any formal publications known to me until Taylor 2009 demonstrated that the numerous characters separate the two species and the giraffatitan is a separate genus with type species G branchi. Clear, right? Yeah, everyone knows this.
No, yeah.
Now, ChatGPT got every single part of that wrong. It left Riggs, Paul Olavesky, and me out completely. It credited Werner Janesh for reassigning a species to a genus whose name was coined 19 years after he died. It pulled poor Ernst Stroman for some reason. It invented the paleontologist Michael Janesh, who is presumably the unholy offspring of Werner Janesh and me. And in all three answers, it insisted that the reassignment was done in 1914, 74 years before the name graphitite was coined. But the worst part is not the errors. It's not the blithe confidence with which the false facts are recited. It's not even the bland, "I apologize for my mistake in the previous response," followed by more utter nonsense. It's that these incorrect answers look so plausible for a layperson who foolishly has not been reading this blog for the last 18 years. The answers here look superficially reasonable. A kid doing a homework report on the Brachiosaurus could take these answers and weave them into the submission without even having an inkling they're completely wrong, and the teacher who has to mark the essay will also likely swallow them. Because LLMs get catastrophically wrong answers on topics I know well, I do not trust them at all on topics I already don't know. And if you do trust them, I urge you to spend 5 minutes asking your favorite one about something you know in detail. Why do I keep banging on about this? Because we've reached an especially toxic phase in the history of AI. A lot of companies have plowed billions of dollars into a dream of being able to replace human workers with machines, and they are desperate to make us believe it's going to work. If only so they can cash out their investments while the stocks are still high. We're in the pump phase of an industry-wide pump and dump. It would be wise for all to be aware about getting suckered in. That was so many words about dinosaurs.
It's difficult, yeah. Turns out they have, yeah, different words.
Difficult so ones.
It's not our area of expertise.
This is how people feel listening to this podcast sometimes.
Probably. Like,
I was thinking about it after the ZFS Size article. We just did the film piece on cyberpunk. It's like, yeah, like academic literature writing is really difficult. I mean, I read a great book. I don't know where it is. I've read one great academic book outside of computer science, and it was about the history of the word processor, and it was really readable. But everything else is like super dense. I have a book on Wares. It's called Wares, or as a friend pronounced it, Juarez. And we had a very funny conversation. And that's like really difficult to read because it's, you know, a sociology text about software piracy. And yeah, I kind of feel sorry for anyone who, like, if you're in the car and your partner has put this podcast on, I'm sorry. These are all real words.
What we're reading.
This dinosaur person could have told me anything. I would believe them.
But basically, when you ask the LLM, whatever it's called, about a topic that you know, do you get something valuable out of it or not?
The only thing I've used an LLM for is to warm up my office, and it failed miserably.
Ooh.
And I asked it to be a sentient office, and I asked that how it felt. So, yeah, it was pretty good, but it was also being a room. So
yeah,
asking for complex things. I will eventually wire up all the doors in the house to an LLM so that they can have emotions, but I'm not gone to it yet.
Please turn the doorknob very gently.
Don't have any doorknobs.
Ooh, it's like sliding doors?
No, they're door handles.
Ah.
This distinction is quite important because doorknobs are an accessibility issue. Anyway,
Easy Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups. And Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud so that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what data is duplicated so that bandwidth can be saved. It then assembles your data into compressed blocks, encrypts them with your local private key that never leaves your system, and then uploads those encrypted blocks to the cloud. So even if someone is able to obtain your backed up data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code to make sure that it does what we say it does. Tarsnap also does bug bounties if you find errors in the code. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse to not have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
We have feedback this week. Nicely.
It's not really a question, is it?
it's feedback of sorts. It's always good.
There's no question, though. I mean, it's great. I like feedback. It's just...
It's more feedback than a question, but Nelson writes us that comments in the latest episode of BSD Now indicate puzzlement over the status of GCC support for Ada. That could be very true. The issue is that two decades ago, about GCC 4 or so, parts of the GCC compiler for Ada were written in Ada itself. This meant that you need an earlier version of GCC to build the newer compiler, and the bootstrap problem exists ever after. This has also happened more recently with support for the D language. If OS distributions always supplied all languages that GCC supports, this would not be an issue. However, some major distributions fail to do this, among them CentOS, GNU Linux, and some members of the BSD family. FreeBSD 15 has a package GCC 6-AUX2018.05.16.3.1. That provides Ada, but it is 9 major compilers generations behind, making it a difficult job to bootstrap Ada support for modern compiler versions. Modular 2 or GM2 has been supported by GCC for a few years now, but many distributions fail to supply it. At Utah, I routinely build new GCC releases every few weeks on our major servers, and my goal is always to include every compiler that GCC can produce. Apple does not supply any GCC compilers, and it has been several years since out-of-the-box GCC releases will build on macOS. Yeah, because they're using LLVM now. There is some work in this area to fix that problem, but it has not been integrated into the master GCC source tree. Okay, that's good to know. And it complements the episode that we were talking about.
People always complain about like Rust not supporting like their Sun Ultra 5. I bet you Ada doesn't run either. I mean, old Ada might, but modern Ada probably doesn't.
Do you know anyone who programs in Ada?
No, I've only ever heard of it as an abstract notion.
There's probably a couple of programs out there that use Ada, and we will get feedback about this as well.
I bet we get loads. Yeah, tell Ada programmers, send us emails.
This would be interesting to see what kind of problems they solve or what kind of areas they use that for. Why not? Okay, what else is left?
That's it.
Nothing?
Whole podcast.
Woo! Next week, another one?
Yeah.
Good. So,
forever.
I'll be there.
We never get to stop.
Okay, we'll leave you with that, and then...
If you enjoyed this, you can send us questions at feedback@bsdnow.tv. You could support us at patreon.com/bsdnow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something like
including
that.
Including the pre-show banter, if you're on a certain level.
Yeah, you could find out what we're talking about.
Mm.
You can come and join us and other BSD fans in the Telegram channel at t.me/bsdnow. I totally read those messages. I don't just skip through them all and ignore them. I read them, everyone. I print them out and put them on our wall.
Which wall is that?
It's not true. I don't have a printer. It's just a lie. You know, it's a lie. I actually do have a printer, but I only print to it using SD cards.
Printing age is kind of over. Whole different discussion.
I was thinking about buying a printer this week, but I think I'll just resist.
Like a color, a laser printer?
I don't know. Dye sublimation printer. I'm going to buy like some amateur hour, but I'm going to buy a good printer. But I also need a laser printer for something. But I just find one. There'll be one in the street. That's not true. I actually have a request for all listeners of BSD Now. Do you find computers in the street? Where? I've never seen a computer in the street.
Yeah, that sounds
disgusting.
It seems
to be an American thing. Walking down the road and I find this old iMac. Never happened.
You want one, right?
If I find an old iMac in the street, I would take it home. But all I find is old space heaters.
Mm.
And I don't want those.
Yeah. You would give computers a good home.
If I wanted to burn my house, then I could arrange it really easily.
Okay. Then, we'll wait for this feedback. And until then, have a nice week.